It's good to see everyone who's here this morning. And I know we have visitors. We're certainly grateful for your being here. Glad you're here. And we want you to come back and be with us at every opportunity you have. I hope we make you feel welcome, so you'll want to do just that. It'll be fairly easy to follow along in the lesson this morning, and I'll get to that shortly. But you might be opening your Bibles to the book of Joshua. We'll start, in fact, in Joshua chapter 1 in just a little bit. But I've got some announcements that I need to make before we get started. One, please add to your sick and your condolences list. Tracy Sharp handed a note to me, and there are three different things, so please listen carefully. She's had two deaths in her family, unfortunately. Her grandmother passed away, and her sister that lives locally here, her sister's sister-in-law, has passed away. So please remember that family. And in addition to that, she has an uncle who has been suffering from some heart problems, health problems. He's had a couple of heart attacks. So she's asking that you please remember her in your family. And as Ed announced, let me just mention briefly, Friday night, if you want to come, we'd love to have you, but there is limited seating. We're going to watch the movie Barabbas, and it is a pretty good movie, actually. There are some interesting things, some very interesting things in that old movie. So come Friday night, and if you want to, see Montel and Juliet. And like he also said, next Saturday, we'll kind of play that by ear. We have no idea. Obviously, you've seen the weather go from snow to what the spring almost today. So we don't have any idea what next Saturday will be. But we're going to do something. So 9:30 next Saturday morning. Without any further delay, let's go to the book of Joshua. And I hope we are. There we go. Let's go to the book of Joshua and talk about another of these stories in the Bible. You may remember that I've done a couple of these before. And what I do with these is I try to go back and look at some major events, turning points in the Bible, but also stories that receive quite a bit of skepticism today, quite a bit of commentary, discussion, both from, and this happens to be one of the favorite, both from believers and non-believers. And I'll mention some of that as we get into it. But to set up this story, just go with me to Joshua 1, and we'll kind of leave that hanging for a moment. And let's very quickly scan the first few chapters of Joshua. And I'll do this quickly. But remember, Moses has died. The year is about 1405, maybe as late, or as early rather, as 1407 B.C. So somewhere 1407, 1405, and I want to stress that because I'd like for you to keep that date in mind for some things I'll say later in the lesson. But it is about 1405 B.C., and Joshua has now taken command. Moses has passed the mantle, so to speak, to Joshua. Joshua is no longer the young, very courageous and strong spy that was sent into the land for reconnaissance back in the book of Numbers. But in fact, 40 years have passed, and so Joshua is most likely in the neighborhood of some 60 or maybe in his 60s. So we think of him sometimes as being a young leader of the army. He's not. He is getting older. He's about halfway through his life at this point. God comes to him and encourages him, says that if you will always be faithful to me, if you will observe everything that I command, I will be with you. Look at verse 5 in particular. This is quoted in Hebrews 13. I will be with you at the end of verse 5. I will not fail you or forsake you. Notice again in verse 6, be strong and of a good courage, for unto this people, the Jews, the Israelites here, unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance of the land which I swore unto their fathers to give them. Now notice, God is going to give the land. And that's very important in the book of Joshua to note that this is not their, as is often said, their taking of the land of Canaan as much as it is God giving them the land. God is dispossessing the land of its natural people, the Canaanites, the Amorites, because of their sin. And a new people are inhabiting the land, his people. And at the end of chapter 1, They make a commitment to God. We will do according as we hearken to Moses, verse 17, in all things we will hearken unto you. We will be faithful to you, Joshua, and your leadership. We will serve God. We will not rebel against any commandment. And you see that at the end of chapter 1. Now, to pass through these chapters quickly, but they do go into the major city, the strongest one they start with first. That may be backward as far as most people are concerned from a military standpoint, but remember, God is doing the fighting for them. So in chapter 2, they go into the city of Jericho, or at least they send spies into the city. In chapter 3, they return and the people do cross over the River Jordan, and there is a dividing of the river that harkens back and echoes back to the dividing of the Red Sea. And that's important because it is the dividing of the Red Sea where Moses told them. They were all anxious. They were worried. They were scared. The Egyptians were pressing down. Remember, we studied that last. As the Egyptians are pressing upon them, Moses says, "Be still and see or witness the power of God." And God divides the Red Sea. Here he divides the River Jordan. So they can be reminded of that. Then in chapter 4, they place this witness, a monument there to remember that. And they camp at a place called Gilgal. Hold on to that because I'll point that out a little bit later. They camp at Gilgal and then they do something that should never be done with an army. They've not been circumcised, so they are. And this will completely debilitate the soldiers. You wouldn't do that if you had to fight the strongest army, the strongest city nation in the land. But again, it is God who is doing the fighting for them. And you see that. I think it is Jesus who makes an appearance to them at the end of chapter 5, the captain of the Lord's host. And then in chapter 6, they march around the city of Jericho and the city falls at the hand of God. Now, unfortunately, as you get into this, what you begin to see, I hope you begin to see it. There we go. As you begin to see, as they pass into this land, well, I wonder why it's doing that, but hopefully it'll warm up. You see a situation in which they've sinned. Achan has committed a sin and taken loot out of the city of Jericho. And they have a defeat. We'll mention this again in just a moment. But they have a defeat at the little outpost of Ai. At a major victory at Jericho, they fall at Ai. But Achan is discovered and punished in chapter 7. And if you're continuing to follow this in chapter 8, they are now victorious over the little outpost of Ai. Now we come to chapter 9. And in chapter 9, and we'll pick up in this story in just a little bit. In chapter 9, they will end up, and let's just say it like that, forming an alliance with the Gibeonites. And that will incite the people, the kings of the various city-states in Canaan. And they will come to do war against the Gibeonites and their new allies, the Israelites. And so there will be a major battle that will take place in chapter 10. We'll come back and read this in a moment. A major battle will take place. And this is where there will be a miracle that takes place during this battle. In fact, I think two miracles, and we'll point that out, that take place during this battle in which the sun will, quote unquote, stand still. Now, when you read such a story in the Bible, it's approached with all kinds of skepticism. And so today's skeptics are always proposing, how can you have an alternate explanation to the Bible's testimony of a miracle like the sun standing still? They began with the proposition that there is no way the sun can stand still. For that matter, in the sense that is meant by it, the sun doesn't move. And so there's a total misunderstanding. This is outdated. Our children will be taught. And people will commonly say today, if you flip on a television, this is the idea you're going to get. The sun doesn't move. The earth is, in fact, the thing that is moving. It's rotating on its axis and it's revolving around the sun. And so skeptics look at this story and they say, you have those who are outright disbelievers in the Bible and they will say it just didn't happen. This is somebody's Fancy is someone's fairy tale. It's another of these ancient myths. All cultures had them. The Israelites had them too. And so, no, this never took place. Others will try to find an alternate explanation. They will say, well, something happened. And most myths, legends, folklore, if you dig into them long enough, there's something behind them. I mean, it's not just pure fairy tale, and that's the common belief today. That's why you have these various studies, about a half dozen of them going on around the world, reconsidering the whole idea of a flood. Not a global flood, but maybe a series of major floods that happened concurrently even, some would say. Because something lies behind the myths and the fairy tales. And the Israelites aren't the only ones to have such a myth or a story in their past. Well, the same is true with the sun standing still. And we're going to talk more about that in the lesson today. So maybe something happened. What happened? So skeptics are always trying to explain away the miracles in the Bible. A well-known story like that of the long day in Joshua. And here's the point. The story is either generally considered one for ridicule. It's ridiculous. The sun passing over us, which never happens, really. We think it like that, but it doesn't. And it stands still in the sky. Some have pointed out, logically, for that to happen, the earth would have to, and very famously, in the Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925, Clarence Darrow did this. As he interrogated or cross-examined William Jennings Bryan, he said, "Do you believe that?" And Bryan said, "Yes. The Bible says it. I believe it." He said, "Do you understand what would have to happen? The earth would have to stop spinning on its axis. Mountains would fly off of the earth. You'd have to defy the laws of gravity. But if you didn't, you'd have the earth crashing into itself. It would blow up literally from inside. Mountains would fly off into space if that's what happened." And Bryan very calmly responded and said, "You don't understand. You approach it from a purely human point of view. And you look at a law of nature, and you look at the idea of a law of nature continuing when in fact it's been suspended." Now we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but the idea is, man is coming at this from, how do you explain it without incorporating a miracle? Because miracles don't happen. And miracles like this surely do not happen. Maybe sleight of hand happens. But you can't have a Red Sea divided. You can have a strong wind that comes and blows back a shallow place in the Sea of Reeds. And it may look as though it were divided when an inch or two water was blown back by a strong wind. That could happen. But a massive division in a sea where there are literally numerous feet of water being built as walls on both sides, that can't happen. The sun standing still so that there is a long day in the time of Joshua cannot happen. Well, let's look at this for a bit. The Israelites are said to have marched around Jericho, and Jericho fell. I believe that's miraculous. Some have tried again to explain that. Oh, there was some kind of sonic boom. They all shouted and they blew trumpets. Well, I dare say, if you look at an ancient description of the walls of Jericho, and you can do that, because they have been excavated. And if you look at those, you can march any number of people you want to around such walls and have them all shout at once and blow trumpets too. It is not going to bring such walls down. But some have tried to explain things like that. No, what happened was God caused the city to fall. And there was that subsequent defeat at Ai. It doesn't make any sense, does it? How can an army defeat Jericho and lose at Ai? Because God is the one in control of this. It is God either fighting for them and bringing the walls of Jericho down, or it is God who is causing defeat at Ai because they've sinned. Achan was discovered and punished. They had their victory, and then the Gibeonites come. Let's go back to Joshua and look at this. The Gibeonites come, and they, in a ruse, and I'm not going to take time really to, you can read through this. You can easily see what happened. But they do get this advantage, and they get this alliance with Israel. Now pick up reading with me, if you will, in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 1. It came to pass when Adonizedek, who is king of Jerusalem or Jebusalem, depending on how you want to look at that, when he had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace or an alliance with Israel and were among them now, that they feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. Now you have to understand what's going on in Canaan. Whenever you have a confederation of city-states, Philistia was such a confederation, five major cities like Gath and Ekron and so forth. There were other situations like that. Whenever you have a confederation of city-states, there has to be a balance of power. Famously in history, Greece was like that. It was unified under the conquering attacks and so forth of Alexander the Great, and then he pushed out of Greece and went across that part of the world. But you have to have a balance of power. Now, if you get a formidable enemy in itself, the Jews, there were some at maybe 600,000 to 1 million men who could fight. That's a formidable army in these days. And if they come into this land, they're strong enough. And if you'll notice, and now they've added Gibeon, a notable city-state in itself. And so the kings are worried. The balance of power is shifting. And so they began to ally themselves. Look at verse 2 again. They feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city and one of the royal cities. And it was greater than Ai. And they defeated it, obviously. And all the men thereof were mighty. And so Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hobham, who was the king of Hebron. And he sent unto Piram, king of Jarmuth, and unto Jephthah. And you can just see this. He's sending out emissaries to these various city-states. And verse 4, he says, come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and the children of Israel. And so the five kings of these Amorites, verse 5, and he names them again, ally with Adonizedek of Jerusalem. They gathered themselves together. They went up, they and all their host or their armies, and they encamped before Gibeon here, and they made war against it. Now the battle begins. And we're going to see this in just a moment. They make this alliance. They come to fight against Joshua, and it will culminate in this long day. Let's read it. The men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp to Gilgal. And they said, notice this, slack not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us, and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal. Notice he's going up into the mountainous area here. That's important. In just a moment, we'll note why. But he ascends from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not. I have delivered them. That sounds very familiar. Chapter 1, chapter 6 with Jericho. I have delivered them into your hand. There shall not a man of them stand before you. In other words, they're going to be utterly defeated. Joshua therefore came unto them, And he went up from Gilgal all night, and the Lord discomfited them. He confused them. He disrupted the armies. He discomfited them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon. And now notice this, and chased them along the way that goes up to Beth Horon, and we're going to look at that in a moment, and smote them all the way to Azekah, even unto Makeda. And it came to pass as they fled from before Israel and were in going down to Beth Horon, notice going down off the mountainous area to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones, or some of your translations will say hailstones. But notice, great hailstones from heaven upon them unto Azekah, and they died. And there were more that died with the hailstones than even that the children of Israel slew with the sword. And then in verse 12, you see, then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said, in the sight of all Israel, sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. Now that's important that you hear that. They had fought all day. And we're going to look at it and retrace this battle in just a moment. They had fought all day. And now the sun is in the process of setting. They're nearing the end of the day. You know how this is. The sun can be bright outside, and you can look over in the sky, we've all seen it, and you see the moon. The moon begins, as it were, to rise. You can even now know, because of science today, you can know what time the sun will rise and set. You can know what time the moon will rise and set. I checked this before I came over here this morning. You will know exactly what time this afternoon. You can look up in the sky and you can see the moon in a bright, sunlit sky rising. Joshua saw that. And he addressed the sun, and he addressed the moon, and if you'll notice, he addressed them by speaking to God, and he ordered the sun and the power of God to stand still and the moon to cease from rising. And they went on fighting. And it remained daylight, if you'll notice here, almost another day's worth of daylight. Now, as we look at this story, this is what we see. I don't know if this map is too clear. I hope it is, but I'm going to put a little bit clearer as I home in on these areas in just a second. But if you're looking at this map, you realize that Joshua is at Gilgal. And the Gibeonites call for him, and they go up. You'll notice the brown part on the map indicates the mountain ridge. They go up into the mountain to Gibeon to do battle. They fight with the Gibeonites for hours. And they kill many. I'm not saying fight with the Gibeonites. Well, I guess they do fight with them. But they fight against this alliance of king for hours. And they kill many. So much so that this alliance, these different nations, city-states, and their armies began to flee down from the mountain. Notice the arrow here. Down from the mountain toward Beth Horon. Literally, if you're looking on a map, you've got a better map. You'll see an upper and lower Beth Horon, two villages by that name. They flee toward properly upper Beth Horon, which is the lower dot on your map if you're seeing that. And God intervenes and begins to rail hailstones down on them. Now, they either do one of two things. Either they are fleeing simply down the mountain and they're going through this, you might as well say, most usable, feasible pass to get down, and they're not really concerned with the direction they're going, and they will want to go south, and they turn then and begin to go toward Azekah, or because God at that point sends the hailstones and they're trying to run from them. I don't know, and the Bible doesn't say. But they change directions, and they start heading south, and they will go further south. Now let's bring up a kind of home in on this area. A little smaller portion of the map here. And notice they're going from Gibeon and fleeing down the mountain through the mountain pass. I understand that this mountain pass is one of few to get down from that mountain, at least going westward. And that it was so used, they had actually someone, no one knows who, but in ancient times, had actually gone, it's very rocky, and they'd even carved steps down the side of this mountain out of the rocks that were naturally there so an army could more quickly march down out of the mountain because this was a battle area. Now they will flee though. God will send these hailstones and they'll flee south going toward that aforementioned Azekah. And God will still continue to rail these massive hailstones down on them, killing them. People, if you can just picture this in your mind, men are falling by the hundreds and thousands as these hailstones. If you've ever been in a hailstorm, And I'm not talking about the little pea-sized hail that falls most of the time. We had a hail storm in Alabama. Wes, you might remember this, but you'd have been a little boy. When he was probably around 4 or 5 years old. And hail came down the size of golf balls. And unfortunately, I got caught out in it. Not long. Only a few feet. I mean, literally less than 30 feet. But running from my car into the house, beat upon with hailstones, and they hurt. And you're holding your hands over your head, literally, because you're willing to break your hand to keep your head from getting killed. And there were people that died in that. Cars were beat all to pieces. All the roofs had to be replaced, etc., on the houses. This was just golf ball size. These are called great hailstones. And so they continue running, perhaps changing direction even again. You'll notice they run as far as Makeda down here. Now, what happened here? Well, they fled through this pass. It was the easiest, quickest route to get away. Joshua and his army were winning. Notice the Bible describes how they fought against them and they died. They were turning back this alliance of these kings. They were running, they were retreating, but God had said they won't be able to retreat. They've come to resist you. Remember, they are being dispossessed of their land for sin. God is not going to allow them to survive to fight another day. You know, the old adage, run and live to fight another day. They're not going to be able to do that. So when they start running from you, I'm going to kill them. And that's exactly what he's doing. He rained a terrible hailstorm on them, and they changed directions once to Azekah and maybe even again to Makeda. Now you should understand that these kinds of storms come up sometimes. Maybe they're always at the hand of God, and maybe this was a special one. I refer you back again to verse 11, great hailstorms. But there have been observed and recorded for us hailstorms where large masses of ice from walnut or golf ball size, we probably would say today, all the way to softball size. Now, you imagine a hailstone. Juliet plays softball. That's a big ball. And if you imagine a softball size hail, and maybe it was even bigger than that, I don't know. But that alone, when it hits you in the head, you're dead. The force that it comes down with, we don't need to get into the physics of it, but the force with which it comes out of heaven, when it hits you in the head, you die. When it hits you on the shoulder, it breaks. If it hits you in the leg, you fall down and you can't move. These are massive stones. They're breaking bones. They're killing these people. And God said he killed more by the hailstorm than even Joshua's army killed. This goes on. It's daylight. They're trying, and you imagine this. It's almost like, if you had been there, you would almost be thinking in terms, if this day would ever end, this would stop. But it doesn't. You've never seen anything like it before. His sun should be setting, but it doesn't. It just goes on. You know, it'd be like around here, somewhere around 4:30. Unfortunately, we're at that time of the year, but it's going to start getting dark. By the time we come to services tonight, it will be black dark. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and this just goes on for these people. Bright sunlight, and it won't stop. Now that's an amazing thing. It would have been a horrible thing to witness. Skeptics charge, it's impossible. First of all, look at verses 10 through 12 again. They say you're dealing with a time when most people had in their minds a geocentric, is the word that's used, idea. What does that mean? It means the earth's at the center of the universe. And we understand that's not so. We understand that even in our solar system, these planets, such as the earth, revolve around the sun, and thus we are a heliocentric solar system. The earth is revolving around the sun. And that what you have described here is ridiculous. Sun, stand thou still. The sun would answer back, some cute skeptic said. The sun would answer back and say, I ain't moving in the first place. Sun, stand thou still. And so it's the idea of something that's impossible. And so it couldn't have happened. But on the contrary, the Bible is simply using accommodative language. I'd like for you to turn over to Matthew chapter 5 and look at verse 45. It consistently uses accommodative language. Jesus made the point, the sun rises on the just and the unjust. The rain pours down on both as well. But you know, I looked at the Weather Channel, like I said, and it clearly says, you go home, don't take my word for it, go home, pull it up, but you know what it says. Or turn on your local news. They are not going to tell you the time at which the rotation of the earth moves to a position where you will begin to see the sun tomorrow morning. Now, I've never heard one put it that way, have you? But they will tell you at precisely what time to the minute in the morning sunrise will come. And in fact, if you notice on the Weather Channel, they've even begun, at least locally for Glen Ridge, they've even begun to put on there moonset, moonrise. You can see that as well. It's accommodative language, that's all it is. Sun, stand thou still. He could have said, earth, stand still. But would you know readily what that means? No, because we don't speak that way. If Jesus said, the Lord makes the earth to receive the sunlight, we would have understood it. But we all understand what is meant by the sun rising on the just and the unjust. It's accommodative language because it's the way we think. And the Bible is written for human beings and accommodates our thinking in those kinds of situations. Now Joshua stands there and he commands the sun to stand still. Let's just ask this question. Because I read through, laboriously, spent a few hours reading through all of these explanations, not by the atheists, who don't believe it, period, but by believers, people trying to help the Bible, people trying to find an explanation for the Bible, believing in God and believing in the story of Joshua, believing that something happened and that this is not merely a fairy tale, trying to help God, and some of them we'll get into very detailed, deep detailed explanation involving equations from quantum mechanics and so forth and so on. Let's just ask a simple question. Was it miraculous or a naturally occurring event? It was miraculous. It was the answer to a prophet's command as he invoked the power of God. It was God's answer as to how He would, go back in the story and look at it, how He would give this army into the hands of the Israelites. God is not uninvolved here. He's directly involved. And so it is a miraculous event. God does this. But understand, with a true miracle, the laws of nature may be suspended by the one that established them. God made the Red Sea. God made seas to flow like they do. God made the law of gravity that pushes water from a higher level down to a lower one. But if the God who made them says, peace be still, they stop. The same power that created something can do with it what He wills. And that seems to be something that even believers have a hard time grasping. Jesus did not pull a fast one when He fed the 5,000 plus with a little boy's lunch, a few rolls and a couple of sardines. He suspended the laws of nature. He created more matter as He did. However He did it. I always think of Him tearing off pieces of the roll and of the fish and it wouldn't quit. He made the rolls. He made the fish. He can suspend the laws of nature and create as much matter as He wants. He doesn't have to manipulate and trick. There doesn't have to be sleight of hand. Now, let's just quickly move on and look at a couple of things. Stories of a long day are a corresponding long night. Because remember, if it's day on one side of the earth, it has to be night on the other, doesn't it? Or that's what you would think anyway. Stories of a long day and a corresponding long night, interestingly enough, occur all around the world. This is not only a story from the Bible. There are even stories of the sun hanging, and this I find very interesting. Even stories of the sun hanging near the horizon, just about to set. You know that time of day when it's getting darker and darker and darker, just about to set, but it won't. It just won't set. It just stops right there. It's like if the sun is going to set today at whatever time, 4:35, whatever it is, it's like it hits 4:05 and it doesn't stop. It's 4:05 for nearly a day. That would be an awesome thing to see, wouldn't it? People remembered that and they talked about it. And while the Bible, I believe, serves as the most reliable historical evidence of the event, there still are corroborating stories. Let me just run through them briefly, just some of them. Notice, a long night on one side of the earth, a long day on the other. That's what you would expect to find. That's what you find. For example, in Canaan itself, the Israelites are not the only one to record the story. The Latin poet Ovid, and many of you might know his name, he records the story of the Phoenicians, just north, remember, on the coast of the Mediterranean. And they tell of a day that was once lost. Because as they recorded it in that place, in that time, you had to have a night, an evening, and a morning to make a day. A day was lost. The sun didn't set, they said. And this went on for nearly a day. In eastern Africa, we're talking about places like Egypt and Ethiopia, and I choose this one from Egypt. Herodotus, the Greek historian, traveled to Egypt. And they showed him ancient manuscripts in hieroglyphics that told of a day that lasted, and they were precise, about twice the normal time. And you should understand that while a lot of people measured hours and so forth by sundials that wouldn't work in a situation like this, the Egyptians had water clocks where water flowed out at a certain pace and they measured hours and minutes. So they were able to precisely measure how long this thing lasted. And so they told Herodotus, this manuscript at least, told him that it was about twice the normal time the sun stayed in the air. But again, if you look back on that map, we'll review it in just a second. You'll notice that halfway between Africa, it goes from day to night. Because remember, Joshua, it's nearing the end of the day. We don't know exactly what time, but it's nearing it. And so he commanded the sun to stand still. So you would expect there to be a night that was about to end in western Africa. It's almost sunrise, but it doesn't come up. And so there's a long night in which the sun just didn't awaken on time, is how they put it. Notice again, traditions in the Orient. Let's go further east to China. Chinese history is well recorded, documented, and it goes back to ancient times, way back. Chinese history speaks of an emperor Yao. He's very well known. He did a number of things. He reigned for an incredible 90 years. Now you might say, that's ridiculous. Wait a minute. We're in a time when men lived, Joshua himself lived commonly 120 years still at this time. Remember? Moses in those 40-year increments. Emperor Yao reigned for 90 years. And his age, that is, that he reigned for a full 90 years and lived to be about 120, 1520, it corresponds directly to Joshua. They even record the dates. Now, they do it differently than we do in the Roman calendar, but it corresponds to the time of Joshua. And he declared in his journals, or annals, however you want to put that, the sun once stood so long that they feared the world would be set on fire because it was just stationary. And if you think like the Chinese do, and you understand glass and the starting of fire and all of that kind of thing, you would fear some continued reflection off the sun would burn up the earth. That's a very real fear. India, not American Indians, but India, Indian legends. There are different ones of them. They attribute the sun standing still at the command of someone that I found about as many names for as you can find, but Arjun or Arjun or Arjuna, whatever. But after the death of Krishna, or again, in another story, at the command of this Buddhist, Matanya. Different stories, all talking about this long day. Come across here to the ancient Americas. You expect to find a long night, and you do. In fact, these different tribes, the Solto, the Ojibwe, the Bunji tribes, these are tribes of middle to western Canada. And they all tell of a long night without light. The sun wouldn't come up to lighten the sky. Go a little further, the Dogrives of Northwest Canada are telling of a time when the sun was trapped, it was caught. And that's the way they thought, but it doesn't matter. They're picturing the sun being in a snare somewhere, much like a rabbit would be caught. And it's trying to run across the sky, but it can't, and the land remains dark. The Wyandots of middle United States, down in the area of Kansas, told a missionary, Paul Lejeune, a story of a long night. They recorded similarly. The Omahas of southeastern Nebraska, Iowa, northwest Missouri, they equally spoke of a sun being caught or trapped like an animal in a snare, and so it could not rise. And in fact, if you look around the country, and I won't bore you with all of that, but there are additional traditions among various Native American tribes in the Northwest, the Southwest, the Eastern Coast, and these are all unrelated tribes, had nothing to do with each other. And they're all speaking of what is called a long night in which the sun doesn't rise. Go further into Central and South America, and you find again a story of a long night. Here are some ancient Native Americans from Mexico who speak of an extended night. Again, in the Popol Vuh, or the Book of Princes, for the Mayans of Guatemala, they've been in the news quite a bit with this 2012 and the world ending. But they have a record of how the people reacted, these very superstitious people, to a long night in which the sun would not rise. And that's the way they were picturing it. It's supposed to be sunrise. It's not coming. And it doesn't come, and it doesn't come, and it doesn't come. According to Montesinos, the ancient Peruvians also spoke of a time when the sun, notice this, was hidden for nearly 20 hours. Now, these are people who build these great structures to measure what time the sun comes up, what time the moon rises, what time that planet in the sky that you can witness moves from here to there. They measured it about 20 hours. This went on. And this was during the reign of Emperor Pachacuti II, and he reigned about 1400 B.C. Interestingly, and I'm going to show a map where you can see this, the Fiji Islands that lie right on the dividing from light to darkness, right literally on it, this particular island, I didn't record the name of the island, but they have an ancient story in which the sun was stopped from setting. It was right there, and it wouldn't set. And believe it or not, they established a day to remember this that went on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, commemorating this event, where they would go out there and they had this elaborate, and I won't talk about it, but they had this elaborate procedure in which they would help the sun to go on and set. And for the coming year, it would set every day like it was supposed to. If you'll notice on your map, all the way to the left here, as it begins to turn from dark blue to light blue, and there's that little dot half and half, that's that island in the Fijis. And if you look over on the right side of the map, where you remember this would be round, it's just to the right of Australia there, almost off the map. That's where that one occurred. What do we have? A long night and a long day being corroborated by people all over the world. What am I saying in this? The Bible's reliable. Why do I believe it? I believe it because God says it. There's enough in here from any of other places we can study to know when God says something, it is so. Even if there were no stories around the world to show that it is so, we would know it still is so. But isn't it interesting that literally all over the world, in every part of the world, someone has a story of a long day or a long night, depending on where they are. I find that extremely interesting. And I find that something that you really have to be trying to deny the truth to say there's no evidence for such a story in the Bible. You can believe in God. You're here today and not a Christian. And do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God with this kind of power, creative and sustaining? And will you this morning confess your belief in Jesus, that He is the Son of God? Will you be willing to repent, to change your life and live your life for our Lord? Will you be baptized to have your sins washed away? If you will, won't you please come while we stand and sing?